NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Oh, here we are again. Greg is off. I tried to reach him, and I failed. So you have twisted my arm into doing a special little effort today.
Yes, indeed.
And let's. Why don't you take it from there, and we'll talk about it.
Well, you know, the last few weeks have been unusual in that there haven't been any major disasters out there in aviation. In fact, the most significant thing the last few weeks is you sent me a new version of the Flight Safety Detective's hat. But really, there was one thing that was straight out of left field, and it involved you. You, soon-to-be Hall of Famer John Golia, are now a Hollywood star. How the heck did that happen?
I wouldn't call it a star.
Are you not getting stopped in the street and at Walmart and in airports, people knowing you by face and coming up and shaking your hand? Has that been happening to you?
It certainly has.
Sounds like celebrity action to me.
Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. last week, and I was in the hotel lobby at 1:30 in the afternoon, and I had multiple people come up to me, four at least, and were chatting about the show. So I decided to get, I had enough of that, and I left the hotel. I didn't go far. I was out in the street, and I got stopped again twice. I had a 4 o'clock dinner scheduled, so I went at 2 o'clock and hung around in an empty restaurant or on their property, and I had nice peace and quiet and had dinner. And then I went to the airport, and I go up and get my picture taken, and the guy there says, "Hey, I saw you on the show. Good job." So I said, "Oh, get past that." And nobody else said anything. Now I'm walking down the hall of the terminal, and some guy sitting in the shoe shine booth getting his shoe shine yells out to me. He saw me on the show, and because he yelled out, the shoe shine guy turned around and said, "I saw you too."
Now so, we have been keeping it under wraps for the last couple of minutes. People are thinking, what show? What show? It's not you being on CNN with Wolf Blitzer, although that did happen because of this. You were part of a six-episode season of what's called The Rehearsal. Now, full disclosure, I never heard of the show until I heard that you were on it. But apparently, this show is catching fire, especially with a much younger crowd. Nathan Fielder is a Canadian comedian who had a series called The Rehearsal. He had the first season some time ago, and the second season just ended in the end of May. And this gentleman, who had no real heavy previous interest in aviation, took a huge interest in cockpit crew resource management, and aviation safety. And he sought you out for a series that he was going to do about aviation safety. And it's not like the usual thing that you and I have done in the past, but this was a comedy series? How does that work?
Well, first off, I didn't know at the time that he reached out to me that it was a comedy series. It wasn't Nathan Fielder who reached out, but one of his other people that worked with him. And the way they it I want to say question, but it wasn't really a question session. It was like a couple, three people chewing the fat. But he did ask me a lot of questions about accidents, which is not uncommon. It's just in the normal course of business when I get talking to people. So I didn't think much of it. And he told me, he said, well, we're going to have a show. Maybe we'll give you a call. Yeah, okay. And they don't hear anything for a long time. And then one day the phone rings and he says that we're going to be shooting a week after next. Are you available? We'd like to have you on the as part of the program. So all this time I've been thinking it's been some sort of a documentary like Why Planes Crash and all that, which you and I both have done. So I thought that's what it was. And I went, and the way they shot it, I mean, they were very, very concerned about leaks and security. So I never said anything to anybody, including my family. But as they were shooting all these scenes, they were scattered all over the place. I didn't realize that they were doing that so that none of the staff or anybody, including me, could understand the storyline that the direction he was going to take this. And I went away and they told me to let me know what's going on. And one day I got a phone call, said it was a Thursday. He said, the show starts Sunday night, 10:30, and you're in it. And that was the first indication I had of a show coming out of this.
Now, there are six episodes, and you were in four of the six.
Yeah, it's in 4 to 6. So I looked at the first one. Still not a lot of direction, but as this progressed, I was starting to think, I hope this guy's straight up because I've been screwed by some of these TV people before, where they cut and snip what you say and it comes out saying something that you didn't want it to say. And so I'm always afraid when I give a lot of statements that they could move it around. But he didn't do that. He was straight up. And so the first scene was all right. Then the second and third I wasn't in. And I watched those and they were kind of crazy. And they were funny in a di odd way, but they were funny. And then 4, 5, and 6 came in place. And by then I saw the direction he was going.
For those of you watching the video version of this, we're putting on screen from the FAA Airman Registry the certification of one Nathan Fielder, who was all in on this. Instead of just making jokes about it, he went through and got himself trained to be a commercial pilot, multi-engine instrument, with a type certification for the 737. And in this series, he is in a 737 flying it. This isn't on the. He was flying it, filled with people. Nathan was sitting in the left seat, but he was not the most senior person on board. You had occasion to talk to the other pilot. He had how many hours?
I didn't talk to the,
Okay.
I wasn't involved with any of the aviate the flying
Okay.
part. All right. But he did tell me when I questioned him after the show was on, he said that pilot he had with him had 5,500 hours and he flies a 737 commercially. All right. So he had experience with him.
And for those of you who have watched the show, everyone on board the airplane who was a passenger was involved in the production of the show. So they did not do anything to risk the traveling public who just buys a ticket to go on an airplane. This was a special thing that was for the show. And apparently it turned out well. And again, for those of you who are watching the video version of this, I'm going to read a comment from Twitter slash X about what a couple of people thought about this. The first one here is from a gentleman named Jake Schultz, and you see a few shots from the show, and Nathan Fielder is a person in the captain's outfit. As a massive Nathan Fielder fan, the rehearsal season 2 might be his magnum opus. Continuously pushes the envelope, the scope and depth he's willing to go to deliver a show that's hilarious while exploring a topic in pilots' mental health. Genius television that I can't believe exists. So let's talk about that. Pilot mental health, that was a thing that you have been pushing in various forms for decades, and specifically about the kind of training that crews go through for crew resource management, you had recommended years ago. that the airlines and the industry up its game. Instead of just doing, let's say, a PowerPoint slide, that you actually go through role playing so that pilots can understand the difficulty in dealing with a situation where the pilot next to you is doing something out of sorts, but they're a higher rank, higher seniority. How do you break in and sort of tell that pilot you should do something different?
It's not easy. It's not easy. I've seen it in the cockpit. I see it in the hangar. I've seen it all over. And I've been involved with crew resource management and maintenance resource management, which I took from crew resource management, and I was the first one to bring it into the hangar. And I had to sell that process to both my airline that I worked for and to the unions representing those people. Because we were going to be stepping off into new territory where we would actually admit that we made mistakes so that we could prevent other people from making the same mistake. So it took a lot of meetings and a lot of balance to get that into the hangar. And it was directly came from the pilots because I worked with ALPA on a number of committees. I had a sort of a special relationship with ALPA. USAA because of the crashes we had, and I spent a lot of time with ALPA in their committee meetings, and I took that from them in 1990. So I started way before that, getting involved with this crew resource management, which really came into its own after United crashed one in Portland, Oregon, and that the crew, 3-man crew, and they were talking, but nobody was listening, especially the captain.
I
So
vaguely
that's what
remember that
started.
one. That was a 78 with a DC-8.
Yes.
Okay, I remember that one.
And so I was bringing those principles into the maintenance environment because I recognized them as they were chatting them up in those meetings. I recognized them as events that occurred in the hangar and that we could benefit from that. So I brought it in. I got the unions involved. It spread on the other airlines and it grew. And we have a program today virtually everywhere. For maintenance resource management. But anyway, that's the hook that I saw when they started to develop this story. I was already there shooting film. I'd already signed the release and non-disclosures, and I never even read them because at that point in time, it was before any shooting, and I just thought we were going to go do a documentary.
And you took that non-disclosure seriously. You didn't even tell your family about the shooting,
Right,
about what you were doing.
I told nobody. So on my multiple trips out to California, I never said a word about the show, and of course the way he did it, I couldn't tell you what it was anyway, because I couldn't make heads or tails of the way they filmed it. So there was no sequence to what I was doing. I was here, I was there, so it was all over the place. So I couldn't tell you what the storyline was until it started to air. Then I recognized a number of the pieces that I was involved with.
Now, let me
So,
ask you this. We've had for decades a problem in communicating aviation safety to the public and to the industry, in that how do you get younger people engaged, whether it's engaged in the career or engaged in the nuances of safety, engaged in taking the profession more seriously? I think Fielder has cracked that nut with this because, tell us your perspective. When you st did start telling your family, who was saying, "Oh yeah, Nathan Fielder. Oh yeah, I saw that." Was it the folks who were 50 and above, or no?
so when it started, when the first episode was out, that Sunday, I told my family that I was going to be on that show that night. And of course, they had a lot of questions. So I have three daughters, their husbands. We talked about it. They didn't know who Nathan was. Right. So, and I didn't either before the show. So we were all in the same boat. We watched the show. So, my daughters told their kids that I was on the show. So they pulled them up off HBO. They went crazy. I got calls from, grandkids. How many grandkids call you all the time? It doesn't happen a lot. They were calling me constantly. They went crazy. They all loved him. They all knew who he was. And you raise a very good point, Todd, in what you said as we led into this about him breaking the code. I have asked HBO if I can have that show, an unrestricted copy, to use in Vaughn College. And we both teach at Vaughn College. And I think you're right. He's broken the code with the young people. And I think since we both teach in an aviation school, I think that we're going to make hay with that, with the students, in order to break down through the cultural difference between us old men and the kids, a lesson in aviation safety around communications.
If they say yes to your class, it's going in my class too.
Yeah, I think that's a no-brainer. I think that's really going to make a difference in us delivering a message to them about communications and working with another person and all the pieces of that puzzle. So it's going to be, I'm going to be very excited to see how that plays out.
Now, just to entice people who might still be on the fence, should I go out of my way to check out this Nathan Fielder work? Here's another quote from Twitter/X from Riley Jackson. With the season 2 finale, the rehearsal has cemented itself as some of the most monumental television in the 21st century. A comedy, psychological thriller, journey of self-discovery, and public safety campaign all rolled into one. Simply nothing else like it. Now, that could be pure Hollywood hype, or it could be the real deal. I got to see this series. You know, I think I have, HBO on my system. I got every other paid channel on it, so I should be able to see that. So it'll be interesting. It'll be lovely, fantastic, if Mr. Fielder would come on the show with us and talk it up a bit, figuring out where he came from.
I've asked him to come on the show.
Let's hope he says yes.
His answer was if we can work the schedules out, he would do it. So I would love to have him on there. Just to pick his brain a little more. I didn't get a chance. We were on CNN together last week, and I didn't really get a chance. As soon as it was over, he was gone. He had to go catch an airplane. So I really didn't get a chance to talk to him about any of that. So in fact, he left the studio before I did. So I would love to get him on in a more relaxed environment and talk to him about, what was going on. But he does raise the issue about pilots' mental health and what they go through and their fears being found out that they have, what most of us would call minor mental health issues. But the FAA will drop dead, man. You got them, you're done.
Which brings me to another point. There's a little back and forth between FAA and this production as to who was saying what about the other. And I believe Mr. Fielder at one point referred to something FAA did as dumb. He's a comedian, not a diplomat.
Yeah, well, the FAA responded to CNN about the show. And whoever in public affairs at the NTSB, I mean at the FAA, didn't do the FAA any favors. That response was one of the poorest written responses I have ever seen from the FAA. So it really set the stage for name calling. Right? And then they were trying to defend that position in the next correspondence they had. So this is aviation safety. Who cares where a problem is identified? Look at what people bring to you, which the FAA almost never does. You get a nice letter. If you were to write the FAA right now, you write them a letter about something you've seen as a pilot, you'll get back a letter from them saying, thank you for your interest in aviation safety. See you later, essentially. Right? And that's their MO. But you really got to stop and think about what people have said to you. And maybe it's not on point exactly, but you need to get some people together and look at it and say, what was this person saying? What did this person see? And is there any meaningful or meaning to what they report? And then you look for the data and you look for the rest of it. Now, all the engineers have to have data. I worked with engineers my whole working career. And I can tell you that an engineer won't tie a shoe unless he has a couple of catalogs full of data about how to tie a shoe. I mean, that's why engineers don't run line operations for airlines, because they can't make a decision without having all kinds of data. Rare. It's very rare that you get an engineer that will move without a whole package of data.
On the
So.
subject of the FAA being sort of like not open to outside ideas, as many of you know, if you're watching this podcast, you're probably watching a dozen other podcasts. You're probably aware of 100 other podcasts, Twitter handles, websites, blogs that talk about aviation safety. If the FAA and the other similar organs around the world were actually innovative and really putting ideas out there and being forward with a lot of thinking, even if a lot of it doesn't really go anywhere, you wouldn't see this market of literally, I don't know how many thousands of people are putting out aviation stuff. A plane crash happens. I can, like, 5 minutes find a dozen different perspectives on that. Now, some of them, are a bit questionable. Some of them are fantastic. I learn from them and incorporate them into the show.
Yes. Yeah, you can't do a blind eye to where any of this comes from. So yes, he's a comedian. Yes, he's a really alternative comedian, the way with his methods. But I think that there's a lot of credibility in what he has raised the issue with, and it needs to be looked at. All the FAA has to do is turn it over to one of the many standing committees they have. I sit on one right now, and in my career, I've sat on, maybe 25 of them in total. Okay. There's industry groups all over for virtually every subject that the FAA controls to get industry's input and ideas on whatever the subject is. So to tell this person, this producer here, and other people that send in concerns to the FAA and essentially blow them off, thanks for your interest in aviation safety. See you later. That's criminal. That's criminal because in that pile of stuff that comes to them, there probably has been and probably will be little nuggets that they could implement. And when I look at what Nathan Fielder has done here, he's not asking for a total rewrite of the programs. What he's suggesting requires a tweak on one of the modules in pilot training. They already do a PowerPoint there. They can replace the PowerPoint with a session where you have two pilots talking about an emergency that you can set up. You can set the pieces up to it and have them talk through it and do a rehearsal, like he says, without spending any additional time in the training program. So to reject it out of hand, I think is not in the best interest of aviation safety that the FAA has rejected out of hand.
In my inexpert opinion, I think the first time you have that sort of experience should not be in the cockpit during an actual emergency, but in a protective environment where, sure, you have that human interaction, you have this artificial pressure, but it's realistic emotional pressure. Last time I had a chance to fly in a full motion simulator, it was for 757. We're both engineers. I said, some of the things we've been studying here in the accidents, let's put this failure, and this failure together, make it nighttime in Reno around the mountains, see how hard it is to fly this thing. Man, by the time we actually landed that plane, we had to like sit there for a couple of minutes because we were like, just blown away. And it took us a while to even get up out of the seats. It was so emotionally draining. Nothing like that would have been my response if I'd been reading a narrative discussion of this.
Yes, I've done the same thing. Well, I should say, so the people that run the simulator set it up so that I could sweat, right? So, yes, I've seen it, and that is true. So it's just they need to do something about it. In fact, he talks about, the first officer not speaking up, and he puts it in the context of new. But I interjected myself on CNN, which I sent you that clip. I when they raised it and they were talking about an example, and of course Nathan was struggling to put an example up, and I jumped in. 30 years ago, I show up to I had I do I worked for the airline. I had authority to fly in a cockpit. So I last minute change in flights and where I'm going, I run up to an airplane to catch it. I may have been the last person to get on the airplane. It was that late. And anyway, I get on the cockpit. I get in the seat. The captain is a friend of mine. The captain is somebody I've known at that point for maybe 20 years, socially outside of there. outside of US Air. So I'm sitting down. He's chatting to me. We're waiting for pushback. He's still chatting. We're chatting on the way out. We get on the runway, gets quiet like it's supposed to, and we take off. But as soon as the gear came up, he starts talking again. And I don't interrupt him. I let it run for a minute and a half, 2 minutes. First officer never spoke up. And finally, I said to him, "Let's continue this at 10,000 feet." And he then realized, that we're in the sterile cockpit mode. The only conversation allowed is that pertinent to flying the airplane. And so he quieted down. And after we got up over 10,000 feet, we started chatting some more.
And
Right.
that lasts until 10,000 feet. That's a standard
Yeah.
thing across aviation for airline flying.
It's an FAA requirement. But the point is that the first officer, who wasn't new, he never said a word. Right. So he was flying. He was the pilot flying as well. So, just for what it's worth, I've seen that. And that's probably why Nathan got me involved so easily. Because when I realized what the subject matter was, I know that that's a problem. We've had this discussion. Virtually every accident that I was in at US Air, we've had that discussion. At the NTSB, we had those kinds of discussions, including discussions around role playing. Before we made the recommendation, because the recommendation that he quoted occurred after I left the NTSB. However, we had those discussions, and I was going to go back and look in previous reports to try to find it, but I never did. We've been doing that. And the reason why we did it is because in our trading of knowledge and in procedures with the Europeans, we were very close with the AAIB, the Denmark, Norwegian, the Low Countries. They're excellent. The French. Right, so they're essentially the leaders in accident investigation in Europe, and they already had it in place. So it wasn't like we were dreaming this up out of the blue and buying a pig in a poke. They were already using it in Europe and already having quite a large amount of success with it. So we were just copying what is already there and already being performed. So, that cross-pollination, if you will, between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Western Europe, there's a lot of that. I spent a lot of time with my own as a board member when we went over for whatever functions we were going over to Europe for. I always spent time if I was in England with the AAIB, their equivalent of the NTSB, or the DGAC, in France, I stayed put time in with them. And then they sent their people over to the US, so, and they were trained on how we do things. We were looking at how they do things because, nobody knows it all. You don't have a lock on all the information about anything. So as long as you keep your ears open, pay attention, listen to what other people do, watch what other people do, and see if it works in your organization, you can come out ahead without having to stumble through and discover something from scratch yourself.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Hi, my name is Marcy Veroni, and I'm in charge of training the underwriters that work here at Avemco. We have a Redbird simulator that we use in our training. It's a 172S model. Our local flight school also has 172s, so we hope that the non-pilots get the interest to go and then become pilots. But regardless, everybody that work here goes through ground school, either Sporties or King, and then we actually put them in the sim. We hire local CFIs to come in and take them through different scenarios. Then we take them to the airport. They've all watched an engine being torn down. They've all pre-flighted an airplane. Most of them have gone for a flight in an airplane. But the reason why I really like the sim is when there is a claim somewhere around the country, we're able to bring our team in here and fly the scenario and kind of teach them the mindset of the pilot in might of, you know, what went wrong? Or is there anything from our point of view that we can help with the next caller that maybe wants to buy that airplane or do the scenario? So
when you're talking to an Abemco underwriter, you're getting somebody who really understands aviation. Even if they don't have a pilot certificate, they do understand aviation. You can tell them your story, you can give them your information, and they can do a fair and appropriate evaluation to issue you insurance.
And now, back to the Flight Safety Detectives.
The show was very enlightening in all those areas. So I really hope that the government picks up on it, the FAA, and Congress should also get involved, because when Congress raises issues with agencies like the FAA, they listen. Needless to say, because Congress, especially the House, controls their money. And if the committee that controls your money is not happy with you, you might find yourself on the losing end of a tug of war with the budget, because the budget is everybody's looking for a piece. And sometimes they have to steal their piece from you, from your agency, to get what they want. So there's a lot of stalking the table over resources. So, and if you get a congressman that in a key committee that's not happy with you, you may find yourself on the wrong end of some resource issues. And the FAA clearly has in the past.
And with that, I now hand it over to you for the last word.
And as usual, to all of you that are flying out there, if you're going to fly, please do a good job of planning your flight. Do that twice, once before you get to the airport, and again at the airport. And if they don't agree, find out why. When you get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. We still see, as I go through reports that just pop up one after the other, about poor pre-flights and what they mean. We still have little airplanes taking off with the gust lock engaged. And on little airplanes, the gust lock is back on the tail, and they're supposed to have a streamer on it, and many times they don't. And they got these little blocks up there locking the flight controls in place, and people still go out. And you know, the other thing that I'm seeing, and I started to look for it after I started to recognize it, is ground taxi accidents. The number of airplanes that taxi into the gas pumps to go pump gas, I couldn't believe it. And since that's not something that is universally reported, I'm seeing like in over 3 months, maybe 15 of them. I bet you there's three times of that that's not reported. So it's just amazing that the small accidents on airports where nobody gets hurt, just some property damage. And, you know, we're supposed to be professional pilots. We're supposed to be paying attention, taking care. Calls into question some of it. But anyway, after you do a good pre-flight and you get off the ground, put that head on a swivel, because the skies are busy today. And those airports where we have a lot of 172s type airplanes, a lot of training going on, you don't want to be involved in somebody else's mistake. So pay attention, get out of their way, go fly in someplace where you don't have to deal with a lot of traffic. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Avemco Insurance Company has thousands of 5-star reviews on Trustpilot.com. Here's one from Henry K., who said, "For more than 18 years, Avemco has insured me and my aircraft.
The cost has been very reasonable and the service excellent. Completely satisfied. The only claim I ever had was handled quickly and to my complete satisfaction. Avemco is a first-rate insurer. Experience the advantage going direct with Avemco Insurance Group. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.